I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Today, on the 44th anniversary of the murder of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., we're going back to the year that he gave his famous final speech, I Have Been to the Mountaintop. That year was 1968. The civil rights movement was in high gear, as was the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the struggle for justice for migrant farm workers and American Indians. Though the years before and after it were momentous enough, the Summer of Love in 67 and Woodstock in 69, 1968 was a watershed year, a dense roller coaster ride of triumphs and pitfalls. Here are a few events from 68. The Tet Offensive killed tens of thousands in Vietnam. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated just months after King's death. Women threw their bras into public trash can to protest the Miss America pageant. Riots broke out in Chicago around the Democratic National Convention. Elvis made a comeback. Cesar Chavez started his first hunger strike. Richard Nixon was elected president. Apollo 8 orbited the moon and took the first image of the Earth from space, which became a powerful symbol for the environmental movement that was building momentum. A current exhibit at the Oakland Museum highlights the events of 1968. So on today's Your Call, we're asking, how did 1968 change the fabric of our society? And what do you remember about that year? What do you think we can learn from the events of 1968 and how we handled them? What are the parallels with today? Joining us for the conversation is Claiborne Carson. He's a professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, also director of the King Papers Project. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'm fine, thanks. And we've also got Louise Pubels here. She is Senior Curator of History for the Oakland Museum of California, and they are hosting the 1968 exhibit. Hi, Louise.
Hi, good morning.
We're going to open the lines in just a moment to hear from you as well. But let's first, perhaps the most significant event of 68 was the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th. So let's play a little excerpt from his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech from April 3rd.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
And that was the last speech of Martin Luther King Jr. before he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. So, Dr. Carson, let me start with you. Can you remind us all what the sanitation strike was all about? What was going on?
Well, first of all, this was going on at the time when Martin Luther King was planning his Poor People's Campaign, which I would describe as the most audacious Occupy movement in American history, because he wanted to occupy the National Mall and call attention to the problem of poverty. And while that he was organizing that, the sanitation workers in Memphis went on strike. And when he was called to assist that strike, he understood that what better way of making his commitment to what he would call the least of these would be to come to Memphis and to not just aid their strike by talking to the sanitation workers, but draw national attention to that strike. And so I think it symbolizes that last speech, his deep commitment to I guess, radical reform that went far beyond civil rights reform, a transformation of American society so that poverty could be eliminated as a social problem. So he was talking about things that we still haven't achieved even today.
And you were a young man when you attended the March on Washington in 1963. How did Martin Luther King Jr. affect you personally?
Well, I think one of his skills, and you can see this at the March on Washington speech, is that while other people were talking about more limited change, you know, many people who went to the march felt that it was a march to demand that Congress pass the civil rights legislation that was pending. Martin Luther King didn't mention that civil rights legislation. Like he did on many occasions, he went far beyond that, and he started talking about the meaning of the Declaration of Independence and the meaning of democracy. The way I kind of looked at it over the years is that he was carrying on a conversation with the people he called the architects of the Republic, Jefferson. And, you know, when I go to the King Memorial, one of the things we tried to design into it was that he would be facing Jefferson and asking that question, when is America going to live up to this ideal of democracy? Is it simply a check returned insufficient funds? So I think that what he did on so many occasions is that he reminded us that you know, our immediate goals were not the ultimate goal, that we needed to think beyond simply civil rights reform. When the major civil rights reforms were accomplished with the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, rather than retiring, as he might have been if he had simply been a civil rights leader, instead he goes to Chicago and moves into one of the slums in that city and moves his family with him and begins to take on a broader set of issues. And that's what brought him to Memphis in 1968.
And you mentioned the Poor People's Campaign. We have a clip from the Oakland Museum exhibit, 1968. I believe that this is Ralph Abernathy speaking about that. Can we hear that?
King went to Memphis because it was representative in a lot of ways of the problems he was trying to point out in his Poor People's Campaign. They kept asking him to come, and he couldn't see how he could avoid going to Memphis because this was really raising the issue of the working poor.
He was not feeling well. He had a fever, and he had decided to stay home. But when we got to the church, every seat was taken, and there were people crowded around outside in the rain. And so we called and said, there's so many people here, and they all came to see you. You really need to come out and just say hello. And he said, I'll come, but I really don't feel up to making a speech. But once Martin got going, you had one of the greatest speeches of his life.
And that was a clip from the Oakland Museum of California's exhibit 1968, which is what we're talking about. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. And let me ask you one more thing, Dr. Carson. How did King's death actually affect the civil rights movement at the time?
Well, first of all, I think by that time it really wasn't the civil rights movement. I think we misused that term. We kind of apply it to black politics in general. He was really concerned about issues that went far beyond what we would refer to as civil rights reform. He wanted to bring about a radical transformation of American society. He wanted to realize not just the word democracy, but make that a reality of bring every segment of American society into the process of determining the destiny of this country. So, I mean, one of the ways in which you could look at that is and when he gives that mountaintop speech, at the beginning of the speech, he doesn't really talk too much about what's going on in Memphis. He puts it in the context of what's going on in the world, the list of things that you mentioned earlier that were going on that year. You would have to include what went on in Czechoslovakia that year, what went on in France that year, where students almost brought down the government. what went on in Mexico City that year. This was a worldwide transformation, and King brought that to the audience's attention when he said that what is going on in Memphis is connected with what's going on in Johannesburg, South Africa, what's going on in Nairobi, Kenya, and so many other places. So I think that his death meant that we lost that kind of connection of understanding that our struggle was part of a worldwide struggle that was changing the lives and the status of people throughout the world.
And that's Claiborne Carson. He's professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. We're also joined by Luis Pujols, who's senior curator of history for the Oakland Museum of California, and they are hosting the exhibit 1968. I also want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. How did the events of 1968 change the fabric of our society, and what are the lessons we can learn today? What are the parallels with Occupy, for example? And what do you remember about 1968? How did it change you? And if you're like me, and I was only two in 1968, what would you like to know about that time? And what have you learned about that year? What inspirations do you take from the events of 1968? You can join our discussion at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And we'd really like to hear from listeners who were alive during that period and have memories of it. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Louise, let me turn to you and the exhibit over at the Oakland Museum. Why do you think 68 is this pivotal year?
Well, it's funny. I was also two in 1968. But I think you'll find that if you do talk to people who were in high school or college during that year, they will know. They will know exactly why 1968. And even when people lived through that time period, when they got to January of that year, Life magazine did a retrospective of 1968, calling it that incredible year. So even at the time, people understood this as a major turning point for so many different people on so many different levels. It really shaped the identity of a generation, both the way they thought about themselves as individuals, but also how they thought about themselves as Americans, how they belong to the nation, and how they would relate to each other in different ways.
And one of the pivotal things that happened in 1968 in January was the Tet Offensive, which represented a major escalation in the war and was a big shock to American society in that they didn't think that the North Vietnamese could attack in such a strong way. What was happening with the Vietnam War, and how did that change the perception?
Yeah, I think you're right in focusing on the Tet Offensive, because I believe that that's really when public opinion started to shift in a significant way. If you look at places like the Bay Area, there already had been some anti-war protesting the year before. There had been a major protest at the Draft Center. But it was really in 1968 with the Tet Offensive that the nation started to turn against the war. In February of that year, Walter Cronkite did a one-year special. I'm sorry, one-hour special. It wasn't take that long. But, you know, that's when he started to refer to the war as a kind of a time that was a war that was unwinnable. And President Johnson, really took that to heart and said, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the nation. And it was shortly after that that he announced that he was no longer going to be seeking re-election for president. So he also understood the significance of the Tet Offensive in turning people away from supporting the war and realizing that this was not going to be an easily winnable war. They were nowhere near victory.
And at the Oakland Museum exhibit, you have an actual Huey helicopter that has been reconstructed in there, which is a very powerful symbol. And inside of it are objects from soldiers and then these testimonials from various people involved in the war, from South Vietnamese army officials to soldiers. And I'd like to play a clip from that. And this is of a nurse, an American nurse who was working there. You ready, Alan?
First half of the time that I was there, I worked in the intensive care unit. That's what I'd been doing for 3 years as a graduate nurse. But the guys who came to us had massive wounds. And the only good thing about working in that unit was we knew they were going home. They wouldn't be going back into the fighting again. There was a lot of guys losing a lot of legs, a lot of abdomens being blown apart, a lot of chest wounds. So So it was very demanding work, and that was what I was there for. The rest of the unit consisted of guys with relatively minor wounds. Our job was to facilitate their rehabilitation so they could go back to work, is what we called it. They'd have to go back to the unit and go fighting again. I found that to be more stressful than the intensive care unit work, because I couldn't tolerate the notion that I was participating in helping people go back to being maimed or killed or to kill.
And that is an excerpt from the Oakland Museum of California's 1968 exhibit. And that is our topic of discussion this hour. We're talking about that pivotal year for American society and the entire world. We are joined by Luis Pubels, Senior Curator of History for the Oakland Museum of California, and Claiborne Carson, who's Professor of History at Stanford University. So let me ask both of you to talk about the anti-war movement at the time. And what were the parallels between the anti-war movement and the anti-poverty campaign, if any? Dr. Carson, you want to start?
Well, during that time, I actually began 1968 living in Europe because I was escaping from the military draft. I had decided to go into voluntary exile. I had applied for landed immigrant status in Canada. And before getting there, I thought that I might as well spend that time traveling around Europe. So I heard about the Tet Offensive actually in Spain. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was very interesting because I had left the United States in 1967. And as I was away, this tremendous transformation occurred. And by the time I returned in the spring of 1968, that was when the King assassination happened. So for me, it transformed my life. The war, the protests of the time, the Black Power movement, all of those brought about a basic transformation of not only myself, but everyone I knew. My brother went into the military. Two brothers went into the military. One of them didn't come back. So this was I think it's hard for people these days when the war is fought by, maybe a percent of our population, and it doesn't really change the daily lives of most people. The Vietnam War was the last of the wars that was really a war that profoundly affected the home front as well as what happened in Vietnam. And I think one of the things that's also hard for people to understand is that at that point, most Americans had this sense that this nation had never been defeated in a war, that it was just almost inconceivable, and particularly inconceivable that that Vietnam, a small, underdeveloped nation, at least that was the conception we had of it, could actually make the United States go home, that they would prevail in the war. And I think the psychological impact of Vietnam and the protests and the way in which it divided families, the way in which it changed the course of lives, that was something that I think it's hard to get back into that period because, of course, we live in a very different era where we have a professional army and we don't really force the rest of the society to sacrifice very much to carry out a war. But I think in some ways it might be similar in the sense that when we went into Afghanistan, I think it was inconceivable to most Americans that we could not, if the United States used its power, could not achieve its purposes. And I think we're becoming much more, I hope, humble as a nation that we can't simply impose our will on the world.
That's Claiborne Carson. He's professor of history at Stanford University. And we're talking about the year 1968. And I'd like to invite callers to join us at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. How did the events of 1968 change the fabric of our society, and how did they affect you? And what do you remember about 1968? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. Again, that toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And let's go to Ruby in Mill Valley. Welcome to your call, Ruby.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. And I've just been sobbing, actually, as you all have been talking. I was a senior at Madison in Wisconsin and in 68. I graduated in June. And actually, I just realized I started college in 63, and one of my first experiences was the assassination of JFK. So my peers and I were involved, whether we wanted to be or not. It was what was happening. I married my college sweetheart when I was a junior, and he was an ROTC, and I couldn't imagine being a military person, and thank goodness he was classified 1Y because of hay fever or something. And
what does 1Y mean?
I think that means women and children go before you do, you know, because you were going to Vietnam, and it was nothing but swamps. And if you had an allergy problem, you could die. I mean, he had had anaphylactoid reactions to certain things, so thank goodness. I mean... So on one hand, you have the military, and he wasn't pro-war. I think the Tet Offensive, and there's a very good book and documentary called They Marched Into Sunlight. And Dave, and I can't remember his last name, but he was a student there at the same time I was. And I believe the Tet Offensive happened on the same day that the Dow Chemical incident happened on campus. And that was when the first kids protesting were beaten up and clubbed by the Madison police. They just didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to handle these sit-ins. And it was a scandal, and I don't know if you recall it, but Dave's book really juxtaposes this military thing with what was happening on campus. And when Martin Luther King was killed, I think it was a 12-week exam, and it was announced during the exam, and they canceled it, you know. And I mean, we were so knocked out by this. We were shell-shocked from JFK, and now this, and then in June it was RFK, and I'm from Milwaukee, and I would go home on holidays, and it was different there. It was completely different there.
Ruby, I'm going to have you hold on for 1 second because we need to go to a break. But go ahead and stay on the line with us, and we'll get back to you right after the break. We're talking with Claiborne Carson, who's a professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, and Louise Pubels, senior curator of history for the Oakland Museum of California. We're talking about the year 1968. The Oakland Museum is hosting the 1968 Project exhibit chronicling the events of that year. And 44 years ago today, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. So we're asking you, why was 1968 such a pivotal year, and how did it change our society? And what do you remember about that year? Did it affect you? If you weren't alive then, what have you learned about that year? And what inspirations do you take from the events of 1968? And what are the parallels today, especially with the growing gap between rich and poor and the Occupy movements? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, every week. 10,000 listeners all around the Bay Area tune in to KALW, but not at 91.7, but via our online streams at KALW.org. So if you travel outside the Bay Area, or if there are times when you encounter the limits of our signal, the online stream is a great way to stay connected to KALW.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, what are the merits of alternative health care? As the debate over President Obama's federal health care plan continues in Washington, are people looking to alternative and non-Western medicine for effective and affordable care? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. And on Monday, we're going to talk about the realities of being a young person of color in the U.S. The killing of Trayvon Martin has touched a nerve for so many and has highlighted the reality that kids of color are often automatically suspect in the eyes of many. So what can we do to change this? And how have communities of color been calling attention to this issue for years? Today, we're talking about the year 1968 and how did it change American and world history. We're talking about why it was such a pivotal time. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on April 4, 1968. In the same year, the Tet Offensive killed tens of thousands in Vietnam. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in June. Women threw their bras into a public trash can to protest the Miss America pageant. Apollo 8 orbited the moon. The first word processor was created at Stanford. And there's a current exhibit at the Oakland Museum that highlights the events of 1968. So how did it change our society? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. We have full lines right now, but one should open up in just a moment. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also now post comments at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. And Ruby, are you still there?
I am, and thank you so much for letting me go on. And I'd like to just wrap it up with just one comment. When I think to myself, what have we done since then? What have we adults done since then? I was 21 years old then, and have I carried on with Martin Luther King's spirit? And I hope I have. I have in my heart, certainly, in all my personal relationships. But there was a man called Paul Soglin, and he was one of the leaders of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, on campus in Madison. Paul continued being politically active, and he was elected mayor of Madison. And, you know, the campus is one little bubble of 35,000 people in a farmland, and he was mayor for 20-some years because he understood his constituency, and he brought all his democratic principles to the fore to help farmers, and it was great. We were so happy that someone who was a radical protester, could work within the system and get some really good positive changes happening.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Ruby. And Luis actually went to Madison.
I did, yeah. I was actually there getting my PhD while he was mayor, so I'm very familiar with Paul Soglin. But it was very interesting because when I was there, he was a policy wonk, kind of regular guy mayor. But you would see pictures of him during the years in the 60s when he was protesting and sitting in and taking over offices. And so I think you're right. He's one of those people who really was able to carry forward a lot of the spirit of 1968 in through his whole life.
And do you both see that spirit has carried forward? I mean, it seems to me as an observer that so many of the same problems are, if anything, more acute today. Go ahead, Luis, and then we'll go to Claiborne.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really interesting to me that you think of something that happened that long ago as being, you know, in 1968, that long ago at that time was 1925. You think of it as being far past, that we aren't dealing with any of the same issues, and yet we really are. Even just recently, for example, Arizona has passed a law outlawing the teaching of Mexican-American studies in high schools. Well, in 1968, that was the start of that movement when high school students in two high schools in Los Angeles walked out of their classes in March of that year in order to get a Mexican-American studies class started. That carried forward. There were also walkouts and protests at San Francisco State later in that year, and that's often credited as the year as the start of an ethnic studies program in many places. Now we're still having that in the news with people outlawing the teaching of that history.
And what do you see as the legacy of 68, and do you see that many of the same problems are still with us today, Claiborne?
I definitely see many of the same problems that King was dealing with in Memphis and the Poor People's Campaign still with us today. And also I see a rather broken political system that traces its roots to 1968. The 1968, like this year, was an election year. And it was the year of a profound transformation in American politics when the solid Democratic South, at least whites in the South, went massively into the Republican Party, where they have stayed. So that 1964 is the last presidential election in which a majority of white Americans and a majority of black Americans voted for the same presidential candidate. And that is something that has fundamentally, that divide, mm-hmm. That ideological divide that opened up in 1968 is one of the reasons why we can't seem to confront our basic issues. And I think that the way in which that divide opened up over things like law and order and the Southern strategy, the Republican Party, which was really designed to bring white Southerners out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party. And the success of that strategy has been replicated using wedge issues ever since. And so it's no accident that we have a political system now that seems incapable of really addressing the serious issues still facing the United States.
And I believe that the segregationist George Wallace got something like 10 million votes that year and carried a number of southern states.
Yes, but I think even more, it was start of that movement of the Republican Party from a rather centrist party, so that in 1960, many people didn't see much difference between Nixon and Kennedy in terms of their basic policies. But after 1968, it wasn't a great deal. It was only 12 years to 1980 with Ronald Reagan and this takeover of the Republican Party by its right wing, so that there were no Nelson Rockefeller Republicans left after a while.
So this is
something that has profoundly affected the politics that young people grow up in today.
That's Claiborne Carson. He's professor of history at Stanford University. And we're also joined by Luis Pubels, senior curator of history for the Oakland Museum of California, which is hosting this exhibit, 1968, which is the subject of our conversation. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. And let's go to Martin in Oakland. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm so glad that Professor Carson drew the line between the movement, that the events that were going on in 68 in this country with the repercussions around the world. I was living in Paris in 68 and got very involved in what's now called this Événement de la Mort de Mai. I was not out in the streets throwing bricks at police. I was more involved in the political side of it. I was there working in the French movie industry, and so I became a member of Le Comité Révolutionnaire du Cinéma, the Cinema Revolutionary Committee. Everything was called the Revolutionary Committee. And how it impacted my life, I think it was one of the most... I've been a political radical all of my life, but that was an incredible impact, especially seeing how it had repercussions around the world. And as far as the Vietnam movement, just a brief historical perspective note as well, I was arrested in New York in 63 in one of the first anti-war movement demonstrations that took place, mentioning Vietnam as its center. And when people say today, why are you marching? Why do you go out in the street to march for Trayvon Martin? Why do you go out in the street to march against the war in Iraq? I want to remind them that we, with our marching and demonstrating, actually stopped that war in Vietnam, helped hasten its end. So there are victories that we've had, and we must never, never forget them.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Martin. Let's go to Kay in Seaside. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was 25 years old in 1968. I had come to California as a teacher in 1965. And there were so many things going on at that time. I think that Joan Baez had her Nonviolence Institute here in Carmel Valley, which I attended. I was very involved with a man who was at the DLI training in Chinese. And while in the course of being at the DLI, he was asked to testify against some of his friends who had been caught with marijuana. And he said he would only be a character witness for them. And in the end, he was discharged as a conscientious objector, having become one in the service, which was kind of unheard of. But there was also the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. There were lots of marches. I think there was so much going on that really captivated people. My boyfriend and I went from here to Baltimore, Maryland, and I was involved as a volunteer working with some VISTA people. So VISTA was big. That was bringing college students into areas they'd never been before. We were working in a poor neighborhood in Baltimore. The Peace Corps was big. There was a lot of emphasis, I think, on people reaching out, students reaching out, learning about other cultures, learning about other people, community organizing. There was so much that was just a huge learning. And with Dr. King and what was going on, with JFK inspiring us, there was so much right then. Cesar Chavez, I think today I'm involved now as a community organizer in my own community. I sort of took that job on for myself after Obama got elected. But I'm kind of seeing such a huge change now that the wars we're involved in affect, what, 1% of the population. We don't really have all the people involved as we did then. We don't have college students involved. It feels to me like corporations have taken on so much power. Money is so powerful now. And to me, it's very, very important that we get off our couches and that we get out. I'm walking the streets for a couple of candidates that I'm trying to get elected in June. I think that being together as a community, building strong communities, being able to trust and stand together are lessons I learned in the 60s, and they're so important.
Well, thank you so much for that perspective, Kay, and for inspiring us to get active. I want to read a couple of emails. Also, at the time, Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, was censured on the Smothers Brothers TV show, and his anti-war interview with Tom and Dick never aired publicly. And AD says, I just watched it. Thanks. You wanted to... Louise is wanting to say something about that.
Yeah, just a personal connection. His grandson is the director of the Minnesota History Center, which is the originator of this exhibition. So he's told his own stories about being 9 years old and going to the trial and watching that in Boston.
And Louise is referring to the Oakland Museum of California's exhibit on 1968, and I highly recommend it. There's just so much information there, and it's just it's a really interesting trip through time. We've got another email. I was curious, this is from Carl. I was just curious what the guests take on whether Occupy, the Arab Spring, Wisconsin, are evidence of perhaps halting progress toward the democratizing views of King and, to a lesser extent, Bobby Kennedy, or whether Grover Norquist and his view that some people are better than other and deserve everything is correct in claiming total victory. Do you want to take that one, Claiborne?
Well, obviously, I spent my life studying how oppressed people can liberate themselves, and I think that that's... one of the lasting lessons. I really liked the comments that have been heard about people who have kept in the struggle. I give lectures sometimes to young people, and one of the things I emphasize is the notion of the long distance runner. That when I was 19 or 20 or 21, you know, I did believe that change would come dramatically, almost instantaneously. And what I've come to appreciate over the years is that the kind of change you really want to have comes from people making changes in their lives so that they incorporate activism with the process of raising families and getting to know your neighbors and all of these kinds of things that people do, and that they pass those values on to their children. The kind of struggles that we're talking about and what King was talking about at the end of his life are generational struggles. You know, the way I look at it is that we're part of this great freedom struggle in the world of turning the 99% who were peasants into true citizens, actively participating and determining their own destiny. And that's a 200-year-long process, and it's still going on. There's still peasants becoming citizens. And when you begin to look at it in that way, what you see is that even the process of gaining equal rights, even the process of ending colonialism, were just steps along the way to this long-term goal of having a truly democratic society.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. That's Professor Claiborne Carson. He is professor of history at Stanford University. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can also post comments at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Lee in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi, I'm calling in because I was a little girl living in Saigon. I was a civilian, child of civilian parents. My father worked for the CIA. There were many, many, many of us living there with this status at that time. And I was a rather precocious girl, so I used to go out and talk to the soldiers and ask them questions about how they felt about the war and so on. But what I found when I returned to the United States at the end of the Tet, which was, the Tet began on Monday morning and we left on Friday, was that people here were completely delusional about what life was like there. They had this image of little shanties and poor rice farmers. It was a very sophisticated civilization, a very advanced society. Very cultivated. Most people spoke three different languages and read in those languages as well. And secondly, we like to think that we go to these countries and patronize them and improve their lives, and quite the contrary. We know nothing, or we know so little, that all we do is complicate things and impose. But we have not learned a thing, apparently, because that's exactly what we're doing in other parts of the world now. And all this activism, so on and so forth, is, you know, all very well and good. But still, we seem to have this savior mentality, which is completely egregious and counterproductive. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you so much for adding that in. Go ahead, Professor Carson.
That was one of the things that King talked about in his speech at Riverside, is this notion, which not only nations but many people have, that we have everything to teach the world and nothing to learn from it. Mm. And I see that as that arrogance that is a fatal flaw in America. I mean, if we simply had a constitutional amendment that we couldn't invade any country that most Americans couldn't locate on a map, we would get ourselves out of a lot of wars.
And we have a lot of saber-rattling happening right now in the presidential campaign. We got an email from Scott in San Francisco. Excuse me. I'd like to underscore Professor Carson's observation about the significance of the draft for the anti-war movement. As he observed, with conscription, every family or most of average means ran the risk of a loved one's direct involvement in the war, which was a huge factor in turning the country against the war. Today we have an outsourced war and made the military job performed mainly by the working class with few economic options. In 1968, I gave up my student deferment and enlisted to organize against the war in what seemed like the best place to do that from within. The GI movement, as it was known, was a significant but little-known factor in the collapse of the war effort. And thank you for that email, Scott, in San Francisco. Louise, you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to underscore what he was saying as well, that that's a real major difference between the war in Vietnam and our wars today is the impact of the draft. But also there are other significant ways that the war is brought home to people in Vietnam that in ways that they're not today. And one of them is the role of the media. One of the things in the 1968 exhibit that was so shocking to me, and I think for a lot of people, is there's a television set running in the living room where the Huey helicopter has landed with a film that was taken off of television in 1968. People today, when you see the media, they're quote-unquote embedded with the military, but that means that they're actually kept at quite a distance. People in their living rooms were seeing shots of people being shot and killed. They were in the battlefields. This was very much brought home over the dinner table in your house.
And the coffins were seen on TV.
And the coffins were seen on TV.
Was barred.
Exactly. And the casualty rates were so much higher. You know, the casualty rate for Iraq for the entire run of the Iraq War has been under 5,000. In 1968 alone, it was over 16,000 Americans killed. So, not to mention all the Vietnamese, not to mention all of the people who have been wounded, not to mention all the Iraqis and Afghanis as well.
But yeah, the fact that there was a draft really changed the nature of how Americans had to view that war.
Exactly. And it touched everyone, I think, in a way that the wars today don't touch everybody in every aspect of society.
And that's Louise Pubel. She's senior curator of history for the Oakland Museum of California, which is hosting this exhibit called 1968, which you can see, I think, through August.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, and let's go back to the phones. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Mark in Redwood City.
Hi, I just wanted to share a brief recollection. I was in Washington, D.C. in 1968. I was an airman at the Pentagon working under a top-secret clearance, and for reasons I won't go into, I had become involved in the anti-war movement, which was a very strange place to be working in the Pentagon. Two things struck me as strange anomalies, and I still don't know what to make of them. The 2 years I had previously been in the military in Southeast Asia, it never occurred to me that there were gays in the military. Because of my ostracism at the Pentagon for being, my attitude toward the war, my only friend there was a gay airman, and it occurred to me as I got acquainted with him that gays were quite out at the Pentagon, of all places, but completely in the closet anywhere else in the military. The other thing I wanted to note, I became an activist, or a volunteer rather, at the Eugene McCarthy presidential campaign headquarters, and over 50% of the college-age volunteers there would confess at one time or another that they had also worked in the Goldwater movement in 64. And we all thought it was perfectly normal. The senior staffers thought we were really, really strange.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for that. Because we're running short on time, I'd like to get in one more call. Sean in Oakland, can you try to be brief, if you would?
Yeah, people have really covered a lot of things I wanted to say quite well, so I'm quite happy about that. I think it went a lot deeper than I thought it would, which is great. I think what's really shocking and sad is that we really don't have a war protest going on now, despite two wars that go on forever, and we really have no war on poverty. And I think the linkage that's very interesting is we have all these ways to allegedly get involved and communicate through technology, which I think is just sort of a Trojan horse that, in reality, if you look at the war organizing in the 60s, anti-war organizing, was so deep, and it basically got through with personal meetings and mimeograph machines and the civil rights movements where people who would just do it on the telephone and show up at church. And you have to get involved personally because you have to take personal risks. That's how change occurs. It's not going to happen on a Twitter feed. I really am feeling sort of cynical about that. But we just have to look at how we've been co-opted, because I think by about 1970, there was a committee by the Olin Foundation, the Coors Foundation, where they were very scared about what happened in the late 60s and social change. And they created a think tank, which basically reinvented language and incorporated that into corporate media. And this is where I think we've been really, really tamped down from that.
And so, Sean, those are really important points, and I apologize for cutting you off, but we just have a couple of minutes left in the show, and I just want to get some final comments so you can piggyback on what Sean was bringing up. And I'm wondering if each of you can just kind of talk about what you think are some of the lessons that we can take away from 1968. Why don't we start with you, Professor Carson?
Well, I think to pick up on Sean's comment about technology, You know, I disagree to a certain extent in that civil rights activists in the South would have loved to have had social media available to them to get the word out more effectively. You know, the movements, the great social movements, used technology of their time very, very effectively. But we have to remember that they're simply tools, that what we do with those kinds of technological advances means everything. Rather than becoming dependent on them, make them tools for our purposes. So I think that one of the things that I see as very hopeful is the notion that, for example, nonviolent activists in the West Bank can upload to YouTube videos of their demonstrations that are going on.
Yeah.
So that people can, in the United States, who are otherwise blocked out from news from that region, can get direct reports from people involved in those protests.
Yeah, that's been
a
very
powerful
tool.
Positive use. Yeah. I don't think that what happened in Arab Spring could have happened without some use of the technologies of our
time. And I've only got just a minute left, so let me just get some final thoughts from Louise. You only get 30 seconds.
That's okay. You know, I think what's interesting to me when we look back on that time period is we often look at it as the roots of a lot of social movements, but it's also, as Dr. Carson pointed out earlier, the roots of our modern conservative movement. And I think we're still grappling with some of those splits in American society, and in a way they've gone even deeper. So looking forward, I think it's one of our challenges as a people is to kind of come back to a common ground together as Americans.
And get away from this extreme polarization. And we're going to have to leave it there. I apologize that we had so many more things that we wanted to talk about, including the sexual revolution. We never talked about Bobby Kennedy. We never talked about the DNC in Chicago. So we'll have to have more conversations about that. We've been speaking with Claiborne Carson, who's professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, and Louise Pubel, senior curator of history for the Oakland Museum of California. The museum is hosting the exhibit, the 1968 Project, A Nation Coming of Age. And we'll put a link to all of that at our website. Thanks for joining us. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about alternative health care, how and why people are seeking out treatments like acupuncture, massage, herbs, and chiropractics. As the controversy over President Obama's federal health care plan continues in Washington, are you looking to more alternative, non-Western medicine for effective and affordable care? Does your insurance cover it? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What kinds of treatments have worked for your health and your budget? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.